It's Baron Sheffield, shitface, and don't you forget again.
Yeah, sure. Anything you say, noble sir.
As smooth and silent as a snake, Campbell lowered the binocs and started to draw his blaster.
Hey, look over there.
The driver pointed to the north.
It's a dish.
Eagerly, the men crowded the obslit, so Campbell stepped outside and walked to the edge of the cliff. Sure enough, there, smack dab on top of one of the crumbling skyscrapers, was a nest of dish antennas, each no more than a yard wide.
I found it, Sarge.
Campbell slapped the man on the backside of the head.
You're dumber than a crap sandwich. Those little things are much too small. We need a dish big as the one back home.
Like that monster over there?
A private, prone in the dirt, looked to the west, cupped hands shading his vision from the sun's glare. Without much hope, Campbell trained his binocs on the indicated area and saw only jungle, heavy infestations of leafy vines crisscrossing the Whitewater River in a dense canopy of greenery. Only the occasional silvery flash indicated water was underneath the covering. Dropping to the ground, the sergeant could now see under the vines and spotted an intact blockhouse sitting on a small island in the middle of the flowing water. The struts and columns were completely engulfed with leafy vines, past the tops of the trees. Then the dish erupted into view, even larger than the one back in Tennessee. Holding his breath, Campbell watched as a bird landed on the dish, then launched itself into the sky once more.
Solid as a rock. Hot damn, we really found one, boys. And no mistakes this time.
That river's going to be a bitch to cross. Probably need to build a bridge to run the power cables and shit.
Standing, Campbell dusted himself off and tucked away the binocs.
Not our problem. We found the fucker, and a Richville right alongside. Time to go back.
Sure hope we beat Alpha Team.
And I hope Brandon got eaten alive. Never did like that butt licker. Sam, how long for us to get back?
The driver cocked his head in thought.
Be there by dawn tomorrow, if the juice holds, that is. We're pretty low.
Then strip the wag. Leave everything but one meal of food and half the ammo. We'll make a tent of tree branches to hide the stuff for when we return. That'll cut our weight and give us enough juice to reach Shiloh.
What are we going to do about Front Royal? It's only 100 miles to the north. Damn big, too. 300, maybe 400 folks. Plus sick men.
Muty shit. Ain't never been a ville that big in the history of the world.
Baron Sheffield will melt that down to bedrock first thing.
The private nervously glanced at the sky.
Not gonna do that here, is he?
Hell no. Sheffield is going to do a lot worse to Front Royal than just chill them all. A hell of a lot worse.
As the twinkling lights inside the swirling mists faded, the door to the chamber was thrown open, and the rest of the companions rushed inside.
You okay?
No damage.
JB fingered a hole in his shirt, where a bullet had come within a hair of blowing off his arm.
Nothing serious, that is.
Mildred gasped, staring at the piles of supplies and ammunition.
Sweet Jesus. Looks like you hit the jackpot.
And Sheffield, too. Doc, don't let that door close. The Blues could be right behind us.
Stepping forward quickly, Doc took a stance, blocking the jam with his body.
We are safe now, my dear Ryan. They cannot follow you with the door askew. And after 30 minutes, Baron Sheffield will not be able to track you at all.
Hopefully. But we'll jam the door just in case. Silas could operate the MAT-TRANS units in ways we'll never fully comprehend. Sheffield may know some way to extend the 30-minute window.
Dean hauled a crate of canned goods to the door, and Doc stepped out of the way as the boy chalked the portal open to its absolute widest.
Sheffield, you go Shiloh?
Wiping off the sweatband inside his hat, JB nodded.
We jumped smack into their warehouse, stole everything we could before the Blues arrived in force.
Send back satchel charge. Forgot 20 minutes. Shit!
Ryan understood the complaint. If two groups tried to use a MAT-TRANS chamber at the same moment, there would be a 20-minute gap between arrivals. That could work in their favor, or against. It was just too big a risk to take at the present. Christy lifted a law tube into view.
Gaia be praised! There's enough MRE packs for a month. A ton of ammo, Grens, Claymore mines. Hey, Doc!
The silver-haired gentleman turned from inspecting a satchel charge of C4 plastique.
Yes?
The redhead lifted a cardboard box into view.
Primer caps, black powder, wadding, and mini-balls. It's for a .45 caliber, though.
I can easily adapt.
Doc smiled, weighing the carton in his hand.
My, my. 50 rounds. It has been quite a while since I last possessed such a plethora of ammunition.
Here.
Mildred offered the men a canteen, and they both drank their fill.
And take these. I found some aspirin in the med kit. I haven't seen one of those since the anthill.
Thanks.
Here, Millie.
Digging into a pocket, J.B. unearthed a small cardboard box and passed it over.
For you.
The physician took the box and slid it open. It was full of .38 caliber solid steel Maxim Express rounds. Immediately she began loading her empty ZKR target pistol. J.B. had gone out of his way to get those for her. In her skilled hands, that slim blaster was more deadly than a barrage of pre-dark rockets. What he could do with explosives, Mildred did with her handgun.
Let's haul the supplies out of here.
Ryan lifted a crate of Grens to his chest and stepped around the military jumble covering the floor.
We have a lot to do before we hit the Blues tonight.
Dean hauled a pack of 6 Law rocket launchers to his back.
We going to wreck first?
Night creep.
Jack slid a knife from its sheath and tested the edge with his thumb.
Mass slaughter.
JB carried a box of Claymore mines into the control room.
Now, here's the plan.
The pre-dark office building rose 5 full stories above Green Coville in Virginia. It had been much taller originally, until the shockwave of a nuke blast that annihilated a coastal Navy base sheared it off clean at the 5th floor. However, the nameless structure was still the highest building in the ville, proudly dominating the crumbling ruins outside and the dense forest beyond. Secmen stood guard on top of the structure, smoking cigs and walking patrol around the towering building. From that vantage point, they could see everything in the ville, down the river to the White Ear of God, and over the high rill to the grasslands of the south. There had been reports of outlanders sneaking through the bush toward the ville, but no sign of invaders had been found by a rec team. However, Baron Duquesne had still ordered an increase in the patrols and even a roof watch. It seemed pointless to the troopers, but a lot better than walking the wall or standing guard in the dungeon where the prisoners wailed and begged to be killed, instead of being slowly tortured for their petty crimes. The lower levels of the building housed the workshops of the ville, looms to make clothing from dog hair, a potter's kiln and woodshop to make spoons, combs, and other useful items. The first floor was the barracks of the Secmen, and the top floor the private rooms of the Baron and his family. The windows were boarded shut with thick planks, inside and outside. There was no way for a Mercy to sneak in for a night creep without using the stairs and going past a score of armed guards. So far, 3 assassins had tried, and each failed miserably. In the middle of the Baron's floor was a spacious ballroom decorated with velvet wallpaper and large mirrors, which made the room seem even bigger than it truly was. Clusters of alcohol lanterns hung from the ceiling above a huge circular banquet table that filled most of the ballroom. Yet the center of the round table was wide open, leaving enough space for a dozen people to dance without bumping the wood and rattling dishes. Drinking and talking, the Baron and senior Secmen of Green Coville were discussing battle plans while lunch was being served by a bevy of young, half-naked serving girls, their budding breasts scarred from splattering grease. As the servants brought heaping platters to the table, the 2 barons would fondle each in turn and discuss her merits with cruel exactness. Trying not to cry from the pain of the pinches, the girls would smile in return and thank the men for the compliments. Standing in the corner where he could keep a watch on everything was the sec chief, Seton Crane. The bony man was sitting in an armless chair with his back to the stone wall, an oversized blaster resting in his lap. Henderson knew that with a word from the Baron, he would be shot dead on the spot. Oddly, the danger excited him, and he found little urge to sneak a dose of the jolt hidden up his ass. Maybe this was what he had been needing all those decades, a sense of danger to keep up his interest. How amusing that would be to discover at this stage of life. The 2 barons were seated near each other for the sake of conversation, Duquesne with armed guards standing behind his chair and seated on either side. Henderson had the same, but his entourage seemed oddly uninterested in the meal and merely watched the visitor very closely. Henderson accepted the scrutiny as a logical precaution. In similar circumstances, he would have placed the visitor in chains.